John Fogerty is one of the few artists on Rolling Stone's list of top 100 guitarists and top 100 singers. He rose to fame as the creative force behind Creedence Clearwater Revival, one of the most important bands in the history of rock. They became even more popular than the Beatles in 1969. He's also had an equally impressive solo career since Creedence broke up, and now he's telling his story, not through his songs this time, but in a memoir from Little Brown called Fortunate Son. And we're rebroadcasting our conversation from October 7th for you now. I began by asking John Fogerty, how long have you been working on this memoir? You're a songwriter, but I assume it's not the same thing.
No, I would say I worked on the book for about 3 years.
And since there's a lot that's been written about you already and about the circumstances of Creedence Clearwater Revival, did people get most of it wrong?
I would say that a lot of the stories are incomplete. They don't have all the facts or all the details of some of the more juicy subjects, I guess you'd say.
Uh-huh. Well, so you're filling in the details here?
Yeah, in some cases. Anyway, you know, when you write a book, how can I say? I naively thought I was going to have my entire life in there. Even as I got well into the process, it wasn't until somewhere near the end I started to realize there's no way to do that. You'll have 15,000 pages, you know, but up until some point that big, vague group of or bunch of material, it seemed like it would all fit, and then I had to start compressing things.
And this is all about the details of your life, Creedence, legal issues, fights, successes. But let's spend a little time talking about the music itself and go back to the beginning. Had you always wanted to be a musician?
Well, I certainly loved music from a very, very early age. And I took great joy in dancing around as a little baby or hearing songs that came over the radio, or even my mom and dad would sometimes harmonize in the car, and it was great.
And you write about a fond memory in the book of your mother playing a children's record when you were young that influenced you.
Very much. We had just come home from preschool, and she sat me down and presented me with a record telling me that it was mine. She was giving it to me, so it was probably one of my only possessions. And she played both sides, and we listened, and the songs were Oh, Susanna and Camp Town Races, which is doo-dah, doo-dah. Mm-hmm. And she explained to me that both songs were written by Stephen Foster. And I took that in, and I think at the time I actually thought maybe Stephen was on that record singing. You know, I was a little kid. I didn't know really the calendar or facts. But, you know, as I grew older, I find that fascinating that she talked about the songwriter. I just really think that's an unusual thing to do with a child.
Well, you were growing up during the early rock and roll era, or
absolutely
more the doo-wop era. Were you influenced by that?
Well, my earliest radio memories, I think, were besides some of the hit parade that was lingering from my parents' music, you might say, the big band era after World War II.
And you cite Charlie Christian as a major influence, probably
absolutely
the greatest guitarist of the swing era.
Yeah, my mom loved Benny Goodman, and so, of course, I naturally checked it out. And, you know, she had the album live at the Carnegie Hall concert, and I eventually bought that album for myself. I loved it so much. And because I was a guitar player, I think, is why I seem to focus on Charlie so much.
Now, can I hear any Charlie Christian in your playing if I listen really carefully?
Some of the songs, I think there's a certain lilt to some of my music. I certainly would call, what do they call it, soft shoe, you know, kind of music to me that almost sounds like Cakewalk or, in a greater sense, Americana. You know, it's sort of a sweet version of blues, you might say. A lot of that music was in the musicals from the 30s and 40s, or a lot of that feel, I guess. And I seem to have some of that in my music. I mean, I dare say there's some in Proud Mary and the way I play guitar. Charlie had a certain way, of course. I just really loved his playing. It was simpler than what came along later, but Charlie was just so melodic and so much swing to his style.
But when I listen to music, I hear such a wide range of influences, rhythm and blues, country, pop, jazz. You weren't born in the bayou.
I was born and raised in a little town called El Cerrito in the San Francisco Bay Area, the East Bay, actually. And I grew up listening. I mean, I think I was blessed. I grew up in a wonderful time in music to be hearing all the influences that you just talked about.
And did you think when you were playing guitar that you actually wanted to make a living as a musician? When you were learning to play?
When I was about 8 years old, I came up with a name for a group. You immediately see where it was influenced from. The group was going to be named Johnny Corvette and the Corvettes.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I was Johnny. And I pictured in my mind we were all wearing matching jackets, probably suits, but kind of sparkly and, you know, and all the same, like we were a group, and we were black. And somehow in my 8-year-old mind, that's what I was going to grow up to be.
My guest is John Fogerty. He's written a memoir called Fortunate Son, My Life, My Music. Well, you mentioned how important Link Wray was to you. How did he influence your sound? And do you think he's one of those people who was really influential but is largely forgotten for some reason?
Absolutely. I think there probably weren't enough hit singles or songs for him to cross over into the, let's say, the mass memory. But all he had to do was the one great song called Rumble.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly was, for all musicians, guitar players especially at that time, it was a big deal. But it was also cool among just the kids, the culture at that time in general. Everybody just thought that thing was just so cool. It sounded, you know, menacing and vaguely like a juvenile delinquent, which is what our parents were calling us.
My father called it rotten roll.
Yeah, there you go. Of course, it made us love it more. That's the way that works.
What about James Burton?
A much bigger influence on my personal style because he did so much recording, of course. James, I first came to know with Ricky Nelson's records. I've read somewhere that Keith Richards actually said, "Well, I never bought a Ricky Nelson record. I bought James Burton records." James was the soloist on much of Ricky's early work, and it was always just amazing. It was such a sound, and it was so inventive. If you were a guitar player, and it was just out of reach. His touch was so wonderful. It still sounds great.
And then he went on to play with Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis. He's on some of Merle Haggard's records. Did you ever get to play with him?
Yeah, I don't know if we've actually performed. I've met James several times.
But you played along with some of the records.
Yeah. Yeah, and talk to James. I mean, to me, he's a god. He's one of the all-time greats.
Well, let's talk about your specific sound. How did you develop it? How dependent is it on the guitar you're playing or you choose to play?
Well, that has a lot to do with it. As a child, you know, as a kid, all I could afford was a Sears guitar, so I bought a Silvertone. And I thought it was cool at the time. And then there came a time in my life where I thought, well, you know, those were cheap guitars. But somehow it all came full circle.
Well, how old were you when you got that first guitar?
I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it on time. My mom co-signed, and I paid her back with my paper route money.
Mm-hmm. And then you wound up buying better guitars.
Yes. And eventually, because I had traded or sold my original guitar, I ended up buying one, a used one, a vintage one by now in the 90s, and it cost a lot more than one I bought.
Well, one of the things about your concerts that people notice is how many different guitars you play. That must be kind of tough during sound checks.
Well, I do try to touch them all, as we say. I really do love guitars. I'm fascinated with them. I love the music. You know, I've obviously dedicated my life in music to playing guitar. And they all are quite different, or at least the ones I use. I really only make a change if I'm looking for a sound that this guitar can't make. And since they all have a specific thing that they can do really well, I enjoy the process of being able to pick up something that sounds perfect for the song I'm doing.
Don't you even have a baseball themed guitar for center field?
Yes, I have a baseball bat looking guitar, and it only knows one song. Center field.
And I don't know of any other guitarist who thinks that way. Sometimes people switch from acoustic to electric. But you really think that each guitar has that much of a different personality?
Yes.
What about amps? They all wind up giving you pretty much the same sound.
They're because they have a specific goal. Of course, there's different size speaker cabinets, that sort of thing, that will vary the sound a bit, somewhat. But you know, what was I going to say? I've lost the thread in my mind now.
Do you have?
Oh, gosh, I may have 200 guitars.
Wow.
What I was going to say is in making records, and this first came to the fore with my band Creedence, I didn't want each song, you know, one after the other, to sound alike. I wanted them to have different sounds and different personalities. And I found that if you needed to change guitars to get that, to go to a different place. And I wanted my band to have a career like that, that was kind of a broader palette than just using, you know, the same guitar to play the solo over and over.
But don't record companies want you to maintain a consistent sound? That's the way sell a band.
In the history of my band, of course, I had much more influence over that sort of that territory than the record company. Obviously, I had signed with a tiny jazz label, and they really didn't know anything about rock and roll. But if you think about it, you know, just picture the Beatles and their career, and they used all kinds of different equipment for different sounds. I mean, they had a wonderful, far-reaching sound palette, I would say, and that was what I wanted to do.
So that way you were able to play music that some critics hear New Orleans in, and then there's country as well. A little bit of whatever you were interested in at the time, or you think of a song and think about it in terms of different genres?
That's a really good question, and the answer is yes. Many times the song itself is suggesting what the arrangement should be. And I guess it's important for me to say that as a songwriter and the guy who was basically in charge for the record making that my band was making, I would have the record in mind as I wrote the song. I could picture what the record ought to sound like. Therefore, I could picture what my band should play to create that sound. And it's pretty well known fact that I was able to give arrangements to the band, actually explain to each guy what they should play. It's an amazing subject that's just occurred to me here. You know, in the big band era, if you hand all the guys in the band an arrangement, no one blinks an eye. They expect that. But somehow what happened in my rock and roll band is people were getting more and more angry at me for telling them what to play.
Because they all felt that they were creators in their own right.
I suppose, yes.
My guest is John Fogerty, who's written a memoir called Fortunate Son, My Life, My Music. It's published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after this.
We're back with John Fogerty, who's written a memoir called Fortunate Son, My Life, My Music. I continue the conversation by telling him, Proud Mary is probably your most famous song, although that must have been aided to some degree by the fact that Tina Turner recorded a pretty good version of it as well.
Yeah, great.
What happens when you hear somebody else take your song and make it her own?
Oh, it's thrilling. I mean, of course, I liked this, my song in the first place, but when I first heard Tina Turner do it, because it was so great, it was such a different arrangement than mine, and I had been pulling for her for quite some time. I was an Ike and Tina Turner fan, probably from the early 60s, and as a fact, our little trio used to do a couple of the Ike and Tina Turner songs, one of which was, I can't remember the name of that one now. Think It's Going to Work Out Fine. Mm-hmm. Awesome record. And so when Ike and Tina had their big hit with Proud Mary, another thing that happened, that they were always sort of bubbling under. It had never quite hit the big time, and that was the song that did it for them.
Did you always write songs?
I started at a very young age, before I was eight, but I do remember specifically at around the time of eight, walking to school and working on lyrics as I went, yes.
With a melody already in your head?
It was certainly a mystical process then. I don't know which was first, but I would think of the melody and words at the same time.
You don't remember that song, do you?
There was a song when I was about eight, I think inspired by perhaps a commercial I was hearing on the radio station. The song was called Wash Day Blues.
Oh, you were writing blues?
Yeah. Well, I was listening to the R&B station. And I'm sure it was, you know, pretty plain and generic, but yeah, and I think there was a commercial they would run about some kind of laundry soap that you should use and don't get the wash day blues, so I try to make a song out of it.
You have a lot of photos in this book, family photos and such, but also one of the photos is of a little songbook from 1967, and the first entry was Proud Mary. Have you saved all of the books that you wrote the songs?
I just had that book in my hand 1 minute ago. For some reason, I got in here without it. But anyway, after I got off active duty in 1967, I decided I should get more serious with my songwriting. You know, up until then, I'd always, if I was inspired, I'd just find a napkin or a piece of paper. It was pretty haphazard. So I went down to the local store and bought a little binder, a vinyl binder and some paper. I came home and put the paper in, and on the first page I wrote song titles, you know, and then the rest was
which were going to give you ideas about what you might want to write about.
Yeah, to me the idea was that, you know, if I had a cool title, that would help me take me along the path to writing a song in that direction. A few days later, I'm not exactly sure how much time passed, but I had the phrase Proud Mary in my mind. I had no idea what it meant, but, you know, since I was now doing this new way of doing things, I found my book, and the very first entry are the words Proud Mary.
You must have liked the title Fortunate Son, because it not only led to a really powerful song, but you've titled your memoir Fortunate Son.
Yes, absolutely.
Was that was it important to you to get that message across in that song?
Yes, way back in the 60s when the Vietnam War was raging at its highest.
And you'd served in the military.
I had been in the military. I'd been in the Army Reserve. And the Vietnam policy, which we don't want to get into all the ins and outs of, but I was a young person who had been drafted, and I was very angry at the prospect that it seemed, as I looked around, that people of privilege did not get drafted, and they didn't get selected to serve in the military, or if they did, they got some cushy office job somewhere. It just seemed unfair, and that was really the point of the song. It was as much about class inequality as it was about the war itself.
Now, Born on the Bayou, which we opened this interview with. Was that one of those song titles that you wrote down?
I believe I did eventually. The song itself became or was inspired by I was playing at the Avalon Ballroom in San Francisco, and it was our first really kind of big gig. We were last on the bill. But for some reason, so we were doing sound check last because they were then going to open the door, let people in, and we would be the first ones to play. And I was strumming the guitar and make sure everything was okay. And I suddenly became inspired, and I told the band, "Here, just follow me. Play this beat. Play this chord." And I started just strumming that kind of swampy, spooky chord and just hollering out nonsensical vowels, and making sounds like that. And shortly around that time is when I was in a totally different setting in my little apartment, just staring at the wall, this is what I would do at night. I think I had discovered meditation and didn't realize it. And I pictured myself going to the bayou. And I remembered that event with the music I had made at soundcheck, and somehow the idea of Born on the Bayou came to me, and at that point I wrote it down.
It does sound a bit like it comes out of Susie Q, Dale Hawkins' song. That must have been something that you'd listened to.
Oh, you mean his version of,
Susie Q?
Absolutely. I was inspired. What I learned about music, a lot of it came from those early records that I listened to. And also, I believe this mythical bayou situation, this kind of southern swampy place that's semi-real and semi-fiction, it seemed to have been kind of pulled together in my mind from the other records I was hearing as a kid.
My guest is John Fogerty. Fortunate Son, My Life, My Music is the title of his memoir published by Little Brown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Your group came along at a time when psychedelic music was really the big thing. Jefferson Airplane, The Grateful Dead, Quicksilver, Messenger Service. And here you are returning to basics, doing tightly structured songs that refer back to the traditions, the rock traditions that preceded. That must have been a conscious decision on your part.
Well, yes, absolutely.
You see yourself as an alternative band in a way?
No. In other words, I wasn't reacting against the other bands in San Francisco, nor was I making a conscious decision to do something different from them. I was kind of going in favor of what I valued the highest. And certainly growing up in the rock and roll era with those records that we all know. But also, I had been to many shows, live shows at the Cow Palace, and maybe more so at the Oakland Auditorium, where they would have these shows where there were going to be, it seemed like 40 people on the bill, and each one would come out and have maybe 20 minutes. And just knock your eye out, But we're talking about artists like James Brown and the Midnighters and Jackie Wilson and B.B. King. And the fact that they only had a short period of time, I think, made it competitive. It seemed that way to me, that this guy's coming out and he's going to lay it all down as quickly as he can and make his statement. And then it just seemed like the next guy would come out and pow, do it even more so. I really enjoyed that ethic. That was something I learned.
That was also the time of the 3-minute record, and you had to tell a big story in 3 minutes.
Absolutely, or maybe even 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
So what was your first band like when you started up?
Well, I actually met two of the fellas that ended up being later in Creedence mm-hmm. Clearwater Revival in junior high. I had started playing the piano in the music room after school. One day I just wandered in there and sat down. The door was open, and I just started playing, some boogie-woogie that I liked. Also a song maybe like Do You Want to Dance, that was a hit around that time. And kids kind of gathered. You know, when I looked up, there was probably 15 kids in there. And the next day, I did the same thing. I mean, it just felt natural to me. And the next day, there were even more kids. Eventually, I met Doug Clifford there, who became the drummer in Creedence, and Stu Cook as well, who became the bass player. And at that time in junior high, we formed a little band, which I called the Blue Velvets.
Mm-hmm. And then when did the name Creedence Clearwater come along?
That happened much later. Basically, we had been named the Gollywogs by Fantasy Records, and we hated that. We
I don't
really,
blame you.
Yeah, chaffing under that.
The Blue Velvets was better than the Gollywogs.
Yes, absolutely. And so we hated the fact that we had no say in it, and we had just been named. And so when the record company changed ownership, the first thing we said was, we want to change our name. So we spent about 3 months searching and trying out different names that we came up with. And eventually on Christmas Eve of 67, I came up with Creedence Clearwater Revival.
In writing this book, there must have been a lot of things that you might not have wanted to get into that were painful. Was it difficult to speak publicly about all the fights, the breakup, the lawsuits, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame meltdown and such?
The drinking.
Uh-huh.
There's things I'm certainly not proud of personally. There's things that are, how can I say it? There's things that just... They seem like they're negative, and why would you want to, you know, spend time dwelling on something negative?
Well, you're not getting yourself into the same kind of trouble Chrissy Hynde is getting herself into these days.
I hope not. I'm not even sure what you meant by that,
because
I don't know all the stuff.
Okay.
But anyway, it just seemed to me that if I was going to write a book, and the whole vibe about me my whole life has been that I'm straightforward, and I certainly write songs in a pretty honest fashion. And it seemed to me that I needed to turn that same lens on myself. I guess I feel that if I was totally honest, whatever my foibles and warts may be, at least it's a document or a record or a history that makes sense to people. And that was really all I wanted to do. Actually, if you tell the whole story, maybe the fans will be able to understand you. You got to be honest for them to understand you.
You think the mess will ever be completely resolved?
People act the way they do. I think in some cases, personalities are just the way they are, and, you know, that's just the way it is.
You've made a lot of your recent concerts available on iTunes, and the economics of the music business sure has changed. Are you happy with streaming, iTunes, pretty much the death of CDs?
I would be happy with the death of CDs if it meant vinyl was coming back. I don't really worry about what you're saying, because it just is our existence. It's what we have now. I do think music sounds better in an analog world. I really do. But most of the, darn near all the people who enjoy music are getting it digitally, and certainly there's a lot of convenience there.
And you're recording it digitally as well, no
eventually,
longer on tape.
Yeah.
You're playing with a new band. How long have you been together?
Well, several of the guys I've played with for years and years. Kenny Aronoff, my drummer, I've been playing with constantly since 1996, I believe.
And you're about to have a residency in Las Vegas?
Yeah, that's going to be fun. I know that may sound a little surprising to people that know me and my music, but the opportunity came, and, I'm going to do it my way, meaning I'm going to play my music, going to present it in a very rock and roll way, not so much of the glitz and glamour you're used to in Las Vegas. I think there's a place for that, for real straight-ahead rock and roll. The way I put it, I'm not going to be changing costumes, but I will change guitars.
Of course. And It must be feel wonderful to have been inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as early as you were. But one of the reasons, I guess, that you can also call your memoir Fortunate Son. We're going to go out with that song. My great thanks to John Fogerty, whose book, Fortunate Son, My Life, My Music, is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. Great to be here.